Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Cooper Talks, and this week I'm going to be taking a break from the Supreme Court and looking at an issue to do with American elections. Well, actually a form of direct democracy, mainly propositions, initiatives, referendums and recall elections. Not something that you may deem or may think of as common in American elections, but nonetheless something that has become increasingly important in recent years to American democracy. So first of all, let's have a quick look at some of these terms and what exactly do they mean. Well, a proposition is just a general blanket term for any measure that is put on the biennial ballot. So every 2 years when they have the elections for Congress and all the other state legislatures and so on that go on, there are a number of issues that are placed on the same ballot paper on the large ticket, and these can be voted for by the people. Now, a proposition can then be subdivided into something called an initiative or a referendum. So what do they mean? Well, an initiative is a type of new law or constitutional amendment proposed and voted on by the people. So it's a law initiated by the people. So a group of people say, we want this to become the law. They get it put on the ballot, and then come the November elections, people vote whether or not they want it to become a law in that state. Now, the process for getting an initiative on the ballot varies from state to state, and not all states actually allow initiatives. California seems to be the easiest one to get an initiative on, which is why they have huge numbers of initiatives every time it comes around. And California does seem to have quite a lax process, whereas others are much tougher. Quite often, what California uses is a direct initiative process. So a petition with the required number of signatures automatically qualifies for the ballot without any discussion. So if you are well organised as a pressure group or an interest group, as long as you can get enough people to sign up to support your initiative, it automatically goes on the ballot without going through the state legislature or anything like that. Now, some other states allow indirect initiatives, and that means that once they get the necessary signatures, it has to be approved by the state legislature, giving some sort of control and maybe tamping down popular passions. So you can argue that initiatives in California are a great source of popular democracy and grassroots democracy, but of course it can lead to a sort of tyranny of the minority, where a well-organised group can get measures placed on the ballot, even if they might be offensive or controversial. Now, what's a referendum? Well, a bit like in the UK, a referendum is a vote by the people to approve or reject an existing law. So whereas an initiative derives from the people, a referendum is confirmation of something that's derived from a state legislature. So it can be a referendum can be triggered in a number of ways. It could be that the legislature sends a proposed bill directly to the people instead of deciding for themselves. So a referendum is a way a state legislature might duck a controversial issue and send it to the people of the state to decide. And that's called a legislative referendum. Now, usually in most states, including California, any constitutional amendments or any changes to the state constitution automatically trigger a referendum, since they require the direct approval of the people to pass. So it's, again, a way of democracy, direct democracy, overseeing the constitution of a particular state and any changes there. Now, the other way that a referendum can get on the ballot is that the people can attempt to repeal a law even after it's been passed by the legislature. So if the legislature, the democratically elected legislature, wants to introduce a new law, it passes the law, the governor signs it into law, but a number of people aren't happy about it, they can try and call for a referendum to remove the law, a way of, if you like, acting as a check on the state legislature. And in that case, it's called a popular referendum. Now, only 24 states actually allow that type of referendum. And importantly, California is one of them. Now, how does the process work? I've already said in every state that allows initiatives and referendums, there are differences and different variations. So you can't say there is one set model. Because they seem to be the most common, I'm going to look at California as a sort of test case for how to get the measures on. But remember, in many other states, it's much tougher to do this. So the first thing that you have to do is you actually have to write the ledger, the measure that you want put on the ballot. Now, anyone can do this who's a resident of California, but they have to make sure it's going to be legally and constitutionally acceptable. So quite often people will access members of the California Senate or Assembly and get assistance, and they're quite willing to assist, help get measures on the ballot, help writing them. Or you can get your own legal counsel or advice. Obviously, there will be a number of people who just write their own but won't necessarily get through. Having written the measure, you then need to submit it to the California Attorney General. Remember, Attorney General is kind of the chief legal advisor, head of the judiciary within the state. And once they've submitted it, it's up to the Attorney General's office to create the proposed law's official title and summary. And that will be what appears on petitions and, if it qualifies, on the ballot. So they have to do the final legal check and make sure everything's constitutional in an order. Once it's been approved by the Attorney General, then you have the job of gathering signatures. So you must format a petition in a certain way by law, and then employ volunteers or even pay circulators to actually go around the streets, talk to people, and try and convince them to sign up. Now, I mentioned pressure groups. This is where, obviously, well-funded, well-organised pressure groups and campaigns have a huge advantage. Not only do they have a number of members already and willing to sign up for a petition, for an initiative to get the ballot on the ballot box, they also have a number of people willing to be volunteers to go out and try and persuade people to sign up to get the measure on the eventual ballot. Obviously, if you're a small pressure group or you don't have these resources, it can be quite tough. Of course, the internet is making that easier and is perhaps explaining why more initiatives and referendums are being seen now than they have in the past. Now, again, the rules for governing how many people you need to sign a petition to get it on the ballot vary from state to state. But in California, you normally have 150 days after the Attorney General has approved the law to get 5% of the voter turnout in the last gubernatorial election. So that's your threshold. So they look back at the turnout of the number of people who actually voted for the governor of California. And if you get at least 5% of the signatures of that number, 5% of that turnout, then it will go on the ballot. So as things stand at the moment in California, you need 504,760 signatures. If you can reach that, it will automatically go on the ballot. Now that's for initiatives. For referendums, it's slightly more difficult. You still have to get the 504,760 signatures, but you only have 90 days following the passage of the law that you want to challenge or change. So referendums are a bit tougher and a bit more difficult to get on the ballot. And again, that's going to benefit well-organised and efficient interest groups. But obviously, they don't want lots of people trying to get rid of laws passed by the state legislature. For initiatives that will actually deal with a constitutional amendment, so an amendment to the California Constitution, there is a third means. They have 150 days to campaign. But unlike regulator initiatives, they need to get 8% of the turnout of the gubernatorial campaign. So that's currently 807,615 signatures. So we have the three measures. An initiative statute that's just an ordinary initiative to try and introduce a regular law. You have 150 days to get 504,760 signatures. For referendums, you only have 90 days to get 504,760 signatures. And for initiatives that deal with constitutional amendments, you have 150 days but need to get 807,615 signatures within that time. If you don't make it, it won't go on the ballot. Of course, some unscrupulous groups or people may think, well, I'll just put a load of signatures on. Who's going to check it? Well, that's step four, where the county elections officials, so the officials who monitor elections, they have to verify and check the actual signatures and make sure the right people and legitimate people have signed it. And they've got various formulas to do that. If more than 110% of the required signatures have been gathered, no further action is required. So if you get an extra 10% of the required figure. Any less than that, however, and officials must do random sampling and determine statistically whether there are enough valid authentic signatures to qualify for the measure. So if you got, let's say, 550,000 signatures, well, you'll probably be fine. Any less than that, and they have to do random checks to make sure these are real people who are actually resident in the state. Now, you might say that seems, you know, a bit lax. Maybe they should check all the signatures. But again, let's remember that it's not actually that common that that many people will sign a petition. And there aren't that many people who will actually go to the lengths of putting a lot of fake signatures on a ballot list. But, you know, it can still be challenged legally. But let's say the signatures do add up. They've all been checked. It's on the ballot measure. Well, then we have the vote in the November ballot. And unless there's some sort of caveat or clause written into the law, the day after an election, if it receives a straight majority of the votes cast, it becomes the law, regardless of any complaints or dissent. The legislature can then propose an amendment or repeal, but it must still pass a popular vote. So under the current system in California, only the people have the power to undo what they have done. If they pass something by an initiative or a referendum, then the state legislature is effectively powerless, and only the people of California can change that situation. So that's the step. And that's basically how you get an initiative referendum passed in the state of California. There's similar processes with slight variations in many other states. Now, what about the campaigns once it's on the ballot measure? Well, like with any referendum or any issue, any side or any group is perfectly entitled to campaign for or against a particular measure. And as with all other forms of elections in America, people will campaign and pressure groups will spend money on TV adverts and raising awareness of a particular issue. So it goes back to the idea, a well-funded, well-organized yes or no campaign can outspend and influence the result in a way that other campaigns can't. So it does tend to give an advantage to wealthy groups and interests or well-organized ones. But they will campaign for it as part of the wider election. And indeed, in some states, they'll actually use initiatives and propositions to try and boost voter turnout in midterm elections. A good example of that is a question that was put on the ballot paper in Maine in 2014. In fact, it was the only initiative that got on the ballot, so it was called Question 1. And that was a proposal to have an act to prohibit the use of dogs, bait or traps when hunting bears, except under certain circumstances. When this actually got on, the final wording of the initiative was given this question. Do you want to ban bear hunting using bait, traps or dogs, except to protect property, public safety or for research? So it's quite a waffly one. The key thing there is how it started, the wording of it. Do you want to ban bear hunting? Now, if you lose the rest of it about bear traps or dogs, etc., and the exceptions, that becomes quite a clear question. Do you want to ban bear hunting? Maine is quite a rural state, and it's got quite a lot of woods. It's got a reasonable bear population and people who like hunting as sport and hunting bears as part of that. Now, these people would tend to vote Republican, even though Maine itself is considered a Democrat state. In 2014, there was really only one Republican senator who was up for re-election in a state that had, in the previous presidential election, voted Democrat. And that was Suzanne Collins in Maine. So if you like, she was a vulnerable senator. And yet, they managed to get, or a group managed to get, this question onto the Maine ballot, the main initiative, and the campaign to oppose it presented it to the main electorate as a ban on bear hunting, an attack on the right to own guns, and there was lots of adverts that gave the impression that by allowing this initiative to pass, basically people would have lost the right to hunt, not just bears, but possibly hunt everything in the state of Maine. Now, a lot of these hunters or supporters of hunting and sports shooting may not have been tempted to go out and vote. They may not have been that bothered about Suzanne Collins. But they were driven or persuaded to go out and vote because of this law. This initiative and their fear of it being passed encouraged more people who enjoy hunting, enjoy guns, to go and vote in the November election. And that may well have been the difference between Suzanne Collins winning re-election and not winning re-election. So they used the ballot initiative to encourage a certain type of person to try and go and vote. And by getting the hunters to go and vote, it gave a boost to the Republican ticket. Now, we don't know if that really was the reason. We don't know if there was any sort of coordinated plan. But certainly, if you actually look at it, the initiative didn't really make, or wouldn't have made much difference to the existing laws in Maine. It really wouldn't have changed very much at all, thanks to the exceptions. In fact, it wasn't changing anything. But it was exploited by certain groups, and it certainly drove a higher turnout than normal in Maine in a midterm election. And a lot of those voters were Republican, and Suzanne Collins did hang on to a seat in the Senate, which is a big victory for the Republicans. So that is a way initiatives can be used or manipulated. Now, you can say, possibly that's a good thing, encouraging people to go out and vote. But of course, it does bring in the politics. Is it really the people deciding, or are the people being manipulated by interest groups and political forces? And that is a question mark against these sorts of ballot initiatives. Now, the role of initiatives in general elections can vary, but it can also give us interesting lessons about the current political issues and climates in America. So let's have a look at some of the initiatives that were considered in 2014 during a midterm. And these show something quite interesting. Obviously, by and large, the midterm elections were a complete wipeout and disaster for the Democrats. Now, the big policy the Democrat Party pushed for was on minimum wage. So Democrat candidates right across America were really pushing their campaign to increase the minimum wage. That clearly didn't work and didn't resonate with voters for the Senate and for the House of Representatives. However, interestingly, the adverts that advocated a minimum wage increase generally, on state-level ballot initiatives, minimum wage actually did really well. No less than four states that elected Republican senators on November the 4th, Alaska, Arkansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota, also approved minimum wage increases by ballot initiative. So clearly, the policy that the Democrats have been really pushing and promoting to try and win the House and the Senate didn't work, but it was still popular with a number of voters, even in Republican states. So perhaps that tells us that when it does come to the elections, partisan politics, supporting your team regardless, plays more of a role than actually considering the issues and what you support. You could also argue that initiatives give voters the way to embrace or opt for these other aspects. And of course, an initiative is a very specific issue, whereas voting for a particular party, you're voting on a broad range of issues and a best fit. So again, it can be seen as good for democracy for allowing voters to choose specific targets that might not be catered for by huge umbrella organisations. Now, in addition to minimum wage, there were a lot of interesting other ballot measures. So Oregon and Alaska voted to join Colorado and Washington State as legalising the production, sale and consumption of marijuana for recreational purposes. Colorado had gone forward with this in 2012. And of course, that's an interesting one. These have been passed as initiative measures coming from the people. They'd won approval and therefore come into state law and show a degree of federalism. Some states still have a complete and utter ban on marijuana, quite a few states, well over 20, places like California, have allowed the use of medical marijuana, so you have to have a prescription for it. And yet other states are going forward and allowing the complete use of recreational marijuana. And Colorado voted to allow people to buy it, and the taxes raised from it, just like with tobacco, would go into funding education. It's become wildly popular. And that's, in a sense, great for federalism. Of course, the problem is you then have this issue of state laws being at odds with federal laws. And what happens there? Well, the police service is employed by the state legislature and cannot be ordered, thanks to the anti-commandeering law, cannot be ordered to enforce federal laws. But of course, federal police can investigate these crimes, or federal agents can, and it does have implications elsewhere. As a small known consequence of the marijuana issue is the problem for banks. The federal government basically treats any bank that knowingly deals in finances deriving from the drugs trade will basically be in a huge amount of trouble, pay fines, and possibly jail terms. Now, of course, in Colorado, there are now a lot of, by state law, legal businesses growing, selling, and promoting marijuana. But if they pay it into a federal bank, that bank can be prosecuted. So unlike other businesses, they basically have a problem. You can't pay the money into the bank. What do you do about employment checks and keeping records? How can you allow your business to grow? Equally, what happens if the president, as has happened on occasion, decides to investigate and perhaps seize some of these assets? You're growing them legally in Colorado, but if the federal government comes along, it's illegal. It does create a two-tier legal system and some complications. But it does show how initiatives are giving more power back to the individual states and allowing a degree of federalism. Another common issue that came up in the 2014 initiatives was the idea of personhood. And this is another example of pro-life groups trying to overturn Roe v. Wade and trying to find ways of stopping the right to an abortion. And of course, there is a degree that they're looking to try and maybe get a case appealed up to the Supreme Court. Now, what these personhood initiatives are about is trying to get state laws to recognise that life, well, basically zygotes are life, or that life begins at conception, and therefore that life has the same rights as a person or a citizen in terms of criminal liability. So effectively, by carrying out an abortion, you are carrying out an act of murder. And if you're carrying out an act of murder, obviously you can be prosecuted and go to jail for life. Obviously, this is controversial, and it does go to the heart of whether or not a woman can have an abortion. Now, personhood initiatives were defeated in Colorado for the third time, so they've been pretty keen to keep getting it back on the measure. So Colorado has defeated it for the third time, and it was also defeated in North Dakota. So there we go, two safe Republican states. Well, Colorado's not, but it did vote for a Republican senator, and yet they rejected these ballot initiatives. However, in the state of Tennessee, they did, Right to Lifers did win a ballot initiative which eliminated any state constitutional protections for abortion. So basically, there are no protections for those people that carry out abortions or protecting abortion clinics. It leaves those people quite exposed. So that's passed and become law. And the state could reverse Roe versus Wade, or certainly if a challenge is brought, a legal challenge is brought to against the Tennessee initiative, that could effectively give the Supreme Court a means to overturn Roe versus Wade if it doesn't over HB2. Aside from legalizing marijuana, Oregon also tried to emulate Washington and California in adopting a top two election system with no party primaries. Effectively, everyone who wants to run would run, and the top two would go through for a runoff election. So you can have kind of the bizarre situation, which we may well see in 2016, where you could end up with the two Democrats or two Republicans contesting the actual election. So you basically get rid of party-based primaries and just have everyone running and the top two get through, which is an interesting one. So California and Washington have done that in the past. The people of Oregon's decided, well, no, we're not going to bother that. The people of Oregon also narrowly rejected an initiative that would have required the labelling of genetically modified foods. And that was defeated by just 837 votes. That is a brilliant example of money making a difference. The idea, in America, they're much more used to and much more content to use genetically modified food, far more than we in Europe are. So it's more common there. But there have been environmental groups and welfare groups and food activists had campaigned and got on the initiative in Oregon, the idea that anything that contained genetically modified food should be clearly labelled. And then the farming industry, the agribusinesses, got involved. They were obviously worried this might affect sales of genetically modified food, and they ploughed a huge amount of money in and swamped Oregon with adverts to try and defeat the initiative. And it worked by just 837 votes. So a great recent example of money making a difference. Perhaps no proposition that's come to the fore in American politics has been quite as controversial as Proposition 8. And this was a 2008 initiative which attempted to change or introduce a new law into the California state constitution, which would clearly define marriage as being between a man and a woman, effectively banning gay marriage. And putting it in the state constitution is a way a number of states had tried to get round the promotion of gay marriage, or after Windsor was struck down, although 2008 is obviously before that, and to make sure gay marriage couldn't happen. And obviously this is what was at issue in the Obergefell case in the Supreme Court. So to begin with, I'd like to have a quick look at the background. Now, in 1977, the California State Legislature had passed a law that said marriage is a personal relation arising out of civil contract between a man and a woman. And so that had clearly banned it. Now, in 2000, voters passed a ballot initiative called Proposition 22 by a huge margin of 61%, which changed the California Family Code to formally define marriage in California between a man and a woman. Now, Proposition 22 was a statutory initiative. It was basically a vote to introduce a new regular law. Nothing special about it, same as the others. It was not a constitutional change. In 2004, the mayor of San Francisco, a guy called Gavin Newsom, performed same-sex marriages in his city. They were effectively annulled because they went against this statute law from Proposition 22. And so the case could then be appealed up to the California Supreme Court, which ruled in 2008 by a margin of 4-3 that Proposition 22 was unconstitutional. And they did that on the grounds of equal protection. It went against the rights of gay marriage, gay couples to have equal protection under the law, and therefore, as a regular statute law, it was unconstitutional. Now, that was in May 2008. By November 2008, Proposition had successfully got onto the ballot, and that was to make it part of the California Constitution that law would the constitutional law would say marriage was between a man and a woman. So they're trying to get it to a higher level law. There were a number of controversies around this, one of which was to do with the wording and whether the wording itself would be emotive. And there was a sort of double trick in the question. And the first controversy was in the title. The title that had been confirmed was Eliminates Right of Same-Sex Couples to Marry, Initiative Constitutional Amendment. And some proponents said that eliminates sounded too harsh, too negative, by saying that it was a right was misleading. So people were a bit concerned about that. More controversial was the fact that the law was given with two different sections. So section one read, this measure shall be known and may be cited as the California Marriage Protection Act. Section 2, Article 1, Section 7.5, is added to the California Constitution to read, Section 7.5, only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognised in California. Now, the argument there was, the first section suggests that California Marriage Protection Act might well be protecting the right to a gay marriage, whereas Section 2, clearly saying only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognised in California, is something different. Actually, they were the same thing. The California Marriage Protection Act was to make law between marriages only between a man and a woman. But there was an argument that that confusion, that double focus possibly, or that possible misinterpretation of Section 1 might lead to some confusion for voters. But it was deemed as being clear enough and it got through on the ballot measure. Having got on there and being approved, the campaign for and against was one of the most expensive campaigns in American history, with well over $70 million being spent on it. Remember, this is just one issue in one state, with some donors giving checks, typically of $1 million, from both sides. So it's a massively promoted and celebrated campaign as both sides try to encourage voters to go out and vote for their side of it. Some of the donors who supported Proposition 8 and the banning of gay marriage, well, you have the Knights of Columbus, who donated $1.4 million. You had the National Organization for Marriage, which donated $785,000. The American Family Association, a conservative group that donated $500,000 as well, many others like that. Those who oppose Proposition 8, who donated money, have the Human Rights Campaign donating over $2 million. California's Teachers Association donating $1,300,000. You've got Pacific Gas and Electric Company, I'm not entirely sure why, but they are, $250,000. The Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Service Center donating $225,000. And so on. Apple as well donated $100,000, and Google donated $100,000. Obviously, they're both based in California, and there's a wanted to get support in San Francisco as well. Possibly a lot of gay rights being considered for their employees. Anyway, that amount of money obviously caused a storm. There were some high profile supporters of the amendment. Probably not anyone that we've particularly heard of, but those supporters opposed to it included celebrities like Steven Spielberg, Brad Pitt, Ellen DeGeneres, Stephen Bing, Barbara Streisand, Rob Reiner, Pink. So they had the bigger celebrity backing, but they still lost. Now, the arguments for and against it. Those who argued in favour of Proposition 8 said it protected the free expression of religion, because they worried about gay rights advocates not affording them the same courtesy, saying, it's the old, we've got our right to our religion to oppose gay marriage, it shouldn't be forced on us. Supporters of Proposition 8 say their support of Proposition 8 is not based on an attack on the gay lifestyle. It's just an effort to preserve what they hold as core values surrounding the vision of traditional marriage. They argued that it overturned the decision of an activist Supreme Court, which had ruled that Proposition 22 was unconstitutional. They argued that it protected their children from being taught in public schools that same-sex marriage is legitimate between two peoples of opposite genders. So again, there is an issue of education there. It also argued that Proposition 8 would protect religious universities and adoption providers, psychologists, doctors, etc., from prosecution for denying services to same-sex couples for any reason. And that was essentially it. Those are the main arguments in favour. Those, I noticed with that they weren't actually criticising gay marriage. They just were claiming it was to defend their religious points of view or protect people who might feel uncomfortable about the idea of gay marriage, but not actually attacking it itself. Now, those who argued against Proposition 8, well, there were quite a few. Basically, the idea of equality, that no one group should be singled out to be treated differently, and that's effectively what Proposition 8 was doing. The idea that equal protection under the law is the foundation of American society. Traditional marriage being a misleading term, various marriage traditions have in the past been abolished, including polygamy, the idea of only allowing members of the upper class or nobility to marry, or having marriages arranged by families, arranged marriages, clearly not appropriate in America anymore, and without people's consent, or only allowing white people to have legally recognised marriages, the bans on people of different races from marrying that were overturned by the Supreme Court. These were all ideas of traditional marriage that have been passed, so it's a misleading term. Current statistics, this was an argument, showed that 50% of heterosexual marriages end in divorce. So the idea that traditional marriage is doing more to degrade the institution of marriage than any expansion of marriage could. You know, if 50% of heterosexual marriages are failing, well, that's more damaging than allowing gay people the right to marry. Voter initiatives to amend the constitution shouldn't be taken lightly. And the idea was the issue was being too simplified. It was leading to a tyranny of the majority, who were perhaps ignoring the rights and sensibilities of a minority group. And that religious rights should not be imposed or have more status than civil rights. The institution of marriage also conveys dignity and respect. Notice those are words that will come up in the Obergefell decision by Anthony Kennedy. And that idea of dignity and respect to a lifetime commitment that a couple makes, and Proposition 8 would basically deny lesbian and gay couples that same opportunity to acquire dignity and respect. The freedom to marry is fundamental to American society, just like freedoms of religion and speech. Although, of course, freedom of religion and speech is clearly shown in the American Constitution, whereas a right to marriage is not. But then again, a definition of marriage is not in the Constitution either. And when domestic partnerships are held as acceptable for marriage, it's misleading. They're not the same. They don't have the same legal status or precedence or tax advantages, which is exactly what was being argued in the Obergefell case, that they were being treated differently. In the end, Proposition 8 did pass in California. And so effectively, gay marriage was once again banned. Now, they did say that those people, those gay couples that had been married before Proposition 8 was passed and went immediately into law, would still have their marriages recognised. And it then led to a number of appeals and counter initiatives. So in 2009, there was an attempt to repeal Proposition 8 through initiative. That failed to get passed in 2009, and another one in 2010 didn't get passed. Equally, the California Supreme Court, a case was brought saying that, like Proposition 22, Proposition 8 was unconstitutional in California's state laws. But on this occasion, the Supreme Court said, this was actually a constitutional amendment, effectively. And making it part of constitutional laws means it is actually okay now. It wasn't okay to ban gay marriage as a regular law, but by making a constitutional amendment and effectively altering the Constitution of California, that made it acceptable. So the California Supreme Court upheld Proposition 8. And so after the Supreme Court in California had upheld it, there was a challenge in the federal court. And the federal court actually said that the California initiative was unconstitutional. And so Proposition 8 remains technically on the ballot box, or on the as part of the Constitution in California. Now, remember, I said right at the beginning with these that only the people can repeal an initiative. However, in California, they've somehow managed to get round this by passing another law called SB 1306, which basically alters California's family code to allow gay marriage to happen, and it also replaces the words husband and wife with spouse. And that passed in the state legislature 54-16 and was signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown in 2014. So although Proposition 8 is still technically on the books, California in 2014 did vote to repeal the ban on gay marriage. And since then, gay marriage has happened. Now, there's still legal challenges going on, but obviously the Obergefell decision would suggest that changes will have to be made, of course. It will be up to the people of California to actually repeal or get rid of Proposition 8, but we'll see. They seem to have managed to bypass it for now. So it was a huge controversy there, and really demonstrates the importance and power and the issues surrounding the use of initiatives in America. So, having looked at some examples of initiatives and how they get on the ballot, let's just have a think about the good and the bad to do with them. So what's the good thing about having propositions used in America? Well, obviously, they are a great way to promote democracy. They help to expand voters' involvement with politics and engage them in the issues. The controversy around Proposition 8, people might not be enjoying it, but it certainly got people debating and discussing the issue. The same with Colorado's marijuana laws and the ballot measures over personhood. They do help engage the public and the voters and get them involved. And of course, as we saw in Maine with bear baiting, it can help get people to go out and vote, which is a great thing. They can engage the electorate and make them more aware of issues and party stances on them, which can help inform their other votes and choices. They're also a great safeguard against corrupt politicians. The whole reason they were brought in was because during the progressive movement in the early 1900s, people felt that their state legislatures were corrupt, and this was a way of checking that the laws that were passed were in the interests of the people, or if the state legislatures were ignoring them, that they could be heard. It also enables decisions to be made on, you know, really controversial issues that politicians might be scared to tackle. Obviously, we talk about politicians ducking the issues, but on things like affirmative action, abortion, drugs, gay marriage, politicians who have to have a wide appeal tend to shy away from these controversial topics. So by allowing politicians to push them to the electorate, or the electorate to take the initiative themselves, that's a great way of enhancing democracy. That's a good thing. Otherwise, the issues just will get ignored. So those are some arguments on the positive side. On the negative side then, well, in a sense, they undermine the ideas of democracy. The cost of campaigns means they're mostly going to be promoted by interest groups or corporations who have the funds. So it ends up being the initiatives that get on, or the promotions of them and the success, tends to be about the wealthy, well-funded, well-organized groups rather than about true democracy and discussion. So it's about a sense of elitism. It also enables pressure groups to circumvent elected politicians. It undermines the state legislature. We saw in California, they can't increase taxes on housing, even though that would be the best way of raising money, and it hamstrings their ability to actually get things done. And it also means politicians who may have debated and discussed these issues are undermined on a popular yes-no topic. And that's bad for liberal democracy, for the idea of considering all people and acting in the best interests of everyone and protecting minorities. Particularly on complex and maybe low visibility issues, big business can end up framing the debate and shaping it and trying to promote the result that it wants. And we saw that with the way questions can be phrased. Obviously, minority groups are likely to be disadvantaged because they probably won't be able to mount such viable campaigns. They won't have the level of support or the financial resources, or possibly even enough people to get a measure on the ballot in the first place. And it can lead to some incoherence in policy making. You know, we've seen in California, voters vote for spending increases, but they also vote for tax cuts. Well, that might be democracy, but it's not going to work in the long term. And California really is suffering from examples of this. And of course, they subvert the principle of representative democracy. It's not that initiatives are undemocratic. A tyranny of the majority is not undemocratic. It might be bad, but the idea of a majority voting and getting its way is the very definition of direct majoritarian democracy. But an idea of a representative democracy with politicians becoming expert and arguing and debating and acting in the best interests of everyone is undermined if we have many initiatives. And of course, with California, the way a question is worded or phrased can manipulate and affect the results. So there's some negative points towards it. Of course, you could also throw in that it's great that it allows federalism and diversity to expand across America, but by the same token, it causes problems for the federal government and a complete hodgepodge of laws across America. It might be what the Founding Fathers envisioned, but can a modern westernized state such as America really cope with such diversity of laws? Those that say yes would absolutely support this use of initiatives and diversity. Those who say no, Well, they'd obviously look at it and say it's undermining the ability of America to govern itself. I leave you to make up your own minds on that one. It's also perhaps worth considering why direct democracy in America has become so important or so popular in recent years. I mentioned the internet as a way of being able to get more signatures in the time constraints, and maybe that has helped it. But there are other reasons. One of them might be for pressure groups or activists, it's a great way of advancing particular interests and things that the risk-averse politicians might not want to talk about. So the idea of tax cutting or, on the conservative side, abortion, and raising it as an issue and getting it debated and keeping it in the public eye. So it's an avenue for activists who might otherwise be ignored by elected politicians. Mind you, some politicians themselves, they're keen to be associated with particular initiative proposals, either to raise public awareness of a particular subject that they deem close to their hearts, or to get the reflected glory from it, to boost their conservative or liberal credentials, or maybe to appeal to a key demographic. So politicians will tie themselves sometimes to these initiatives. The use of initiatives and referendums has also become more professionalised. And this is a nature in American politics. As they become more used, so we've ended up with groups of experts who make an awful lot of money in helping people write initiatives, getting them on the ballot, promoting them, and so on. And this industry, the initiative industry, is actually growing and becoming quite popular. Now, that there's a cynical side that obviously increased costs and it's a self-fulfilling thing, but it does make it easier for ordinary groups or smaller, weaker pressure groups to maybe launch a successful campaign. But at the end of the day, they do charge money and it's going to cost them. And of course, who is employing these initiative industry executives? Which groups are in the background paying them to get these initiatives on the ballot and then campaign for them? If you follow the chain of money, you may not be happy with what you find. And of course, the other one is the news media and the growth of the 24-hour news media. They need stuff to report on. And crazy initiatives or hilarious initiatives give them something to talk about, something to discuss and debate. So the news media has also been raising the profile and awareness of initiatives in general. And those four things might account for the increasing popularity of initiatives and propositions in America. Of course, we can't discount the unhappiness with elected politicians and the growing unease that exists in America, certainly at the federal level, but also at state levels, unhappiness with their legislatures, with gridlock, with partisan bickering. And so people might be looking to initiatives as a way of taking back control and governing their own lives and getting around politicians that they don't trust or feel much kinship to. So again, that could be part of the broader issue in American politics. But of course, initiatives are only in states, and only in about 24 of those states. There has never been a national referendum in America. And it's not even sure that the people of America would want that or what the issue could possibly be on. But there's some thoughts about why they've risen in importance. The last thing I'd like to look at on direct democracy in America is the idea of the recall election. Now, this is something that's recently been passed in the UK as well, but it's existed in certain states for quite a while. And the idea is quite simply, if there's a valid reason, the electorate can recall a politician and force them to face re-election. Now, as ever in America, there are as many options as there are states. So some states, like Alaska, Georgia, and Montana, require specific grounds before a recall can happen, usually to do with serious misconduct whilst in office. In 2010, California tried to introduce an amendment to their state constitution to allow recall. And that's basically because Governor Blagojevich, who'd effectively sold Obama's vacant Senate seat, and was guilty of corruption. They wanted to recall him to remove him. A bit of a problem that they had in Illinois at that time. Anyway, so in those, an official can dispute it, and then it's up to the state courts to decide whether or not the misconduct charge is valid and that a recall should happen. In 11 other states, a variety of them, but California is a notable one, you don't actually need any valid grounds. You just circulate a recall petition, and if you get a required number of signatures, which is usually quite high, but it does vary, then the recall election will be triggered. Candidates can obviously appeal these and say, no, I don't deserve the recall, and give evidence why. But it is based on just a number of petitions. So it's a way of the people holding their elected officials to account. Now, recall elections, while they sound amazing, they're actually very, very rare. Usually the thresholds are very, very high, and it's difficult to actually trigger. But the most famous successful example was in 2003 in California. The governor at the time, a guy called Gray Davis, was recalled because of issues with California's budget. And the issues that came there. Now, ironically, those issues were largely the result of the initiatives that had hamstrung his ability to actually raise money, but had to keep spending money. However, the governor got the blame, and that triggered a special election. And it's quite odd in California, because on the same ballot paper, you have the box to tick, do you want to recall the governor? And if you tick yes, you then have the box underneath saying, who would you like to vote for instead? And you ended up with a sort of free-for-all list, and a huge list of potential replacements put their names down. It wasn't on a sort of two-party basis there. And he was recalled, and in that special election, Arnold Schwarzenegger got enough of the vote to become California governor. Name recognition probably helped him a bit there. So Gray Davis is a big example of someone actually being recalled. There had been other attempts. Ronald Reagan was famous. They tried to recall him. But actually, the Davis case is the first where they'd actually managed to get enough signatures to trigger it. And, you know, it wasn't the first time he'd faced one of these. He'd faced one in 99. But usually they fail to get enough signatures. A lot of people like to give incumbents a chance, support the incumbents. And, of course, in most states and in most areas, you're never more than 2 years away from another election. So, again, trying to get the necessary signatures is kind of superfluous, you know, because you're going to be able to vote them out of office either in the primary or in the actual election within about 2 years. So the need for recall is diminished quite a bit there. Of course, the Senate or federal senators could be recalled. They have their 6-year term, but that's not actually happened. Probably the best and most recent case is the idea of Robert Menendez, who's Democrat senator from New Jersey. And a sort of Tea Party group, the Sussex County Tea Party Patriots, launched a bid to try and recall Menendez. And the New Jersey state legislature basically said, you haven't got a case, you can't do it, because the national constitution doesn't give any provision for recall elections. So effectively the argument they gave was, whatever the state law says, federal senators cannot be recalled. So it's an interesting one. It hasn't yet, as far as I'm aware, been challenged or upheld or struck down by the Supreme Court. So the legal ruling of that is a bit dubious, perhaps. But what's even more dubious, and a lesson of the dangers of recall elections, are the Tea Party Patriots' reasons for trying to recall Menendez. It wasn't at that time — there are issues percolating at the moment — but it wasn't at that time anything to do with corruption or any misconduct of the office. It wasn't because he'd broken promises he'd made on his campaign and voted a different way. It was simply because they didn't like the way Menendez voted. He was a liberal, they were conservatives, so they wanted to get rid of him. And although recall hasn't been popular or hasn't been successful very often, it's a warning of the danger signs of the growing partisanship in America. And the fact that through primaries and recall elections, incumbent politicians are being challenged and removed from office, not because they've done anything wrong, but simply because a group dislike their policies and want to get rid of them, despite them having won a democratic election. And that, you know, democracy is a wonderful and amazing thing, but at times it can be open to abuse. And there is a danger if people start trying to simply remove elected politicians because they happen to disagree with their policies. And it could, in the end, lead to far more elections, which I think the apathetic American voting population could do without. Anyway, mostly focusing on initiatives and propositions and ballot measures there, but also look at recall elections. I hope that's helped and you've got a good understanding now of the ideas of direct democracy in America with a good range of examples. And I'll speak to you again next week. Thank you very much for listening.